But the spark is in each of us, and it's a soul that is guiding us back to the divine, to its own divine nature. And I found the answer in the Earth Charter, which says human development is primarily about being more rather than having more. And I think my main point is that society should be organized to give us, help us become who we are and be a better person, simply.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. So friends, are you ready to join me? Let's do this. Hey friends, did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them, and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. And new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Oh my goodness, friends, you are in for an inspiring special treat today. It was such an honor to connect with Thomas Legrand for his incredible work, Politics of Being. This episode is a little bit different from a lot of the episodes I have on this show. It is really a discussion of worldviews, paradigms, and the ultimate state of humanity. Thomas does so much incredible work for our world. He even works with the United Nations, and it is all in the mission of creating a better world for all of us. In his book, he proposes the idea of a political system for the world based on spiritual values and a state of being rather than a state of having. And we will define all of this and talk about it in the episode. And while what he's saying may seem a little bit like a utopia, Thomas does provide very practical ways that it can be implemented and actually happen. In this episode, we talk about things like the evolution and future of humanity, the difference between spirituality and religion, what a value-based society looks like, whether or not you can truly be altruistic, does selflessness actually exist, whether the world is actually safer and more peaceful than it ever has been before, how to truly better oneself, and so much more. The show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/politicsofbeing. Those show notes will have a full transcript as well as links to everything that we talked about, so definitely check that out. I can't wait to hear what you guys think. Definitely let me know in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers. Intermittent fasting plus real foods plus life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. All right, I think that's all the things. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with the incredible human Thomas Legrand. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited and honored about the conversation I am about to have. So it is about a very inspiring, beautiful topic, and not one that I focus on much, usually not entirely. It comes up tangentially, the topics we discuss here, but as a whole, I have not done an episode, I don't think, on a paradigm surrounding politics, and in particular, a new version of politics, one that is really about supporting the true meaning and purpose of humanity, one rooted in sustainability and spirituality, which we're going to define all of these words because I know definitions are very important. The title of the book is Politics of Being, Wisdom and Science for a New Development Paradigm. It is written by Thomas Legrand. He holds a PhD in ecological economics, and he studied international development, political science, and management, and he works in the field of sustainability for UN agencies, companies, and NGOs. And friends, this book, when it first came across my consciousness, I was really intrigued by just the title, which seemed, you know, a little esoteric. I was curious what the work was actually going to entail and advocate for. I was excited because when I started reading it, pretty near the beginning, it introduced the work of Charles Eisenstein, who I have had on this show as well. I will put a link to that episode. He came on for his book, The Coronation. But in any case, The Politics of Being is just a grand exploration of so many topics. Like I said, it's a proposal for a new paradigm of viewing the world, one where values really inform the decisions that we make as a society, as a system, what that all means. It touches on so many things like education and, of course, things like diet and the environment and mindfulness and meditation and just what this new approach would
practically look like in society? And so I have so many questions. I'm really excited to dive into this. Thomas, thank you so much for your work and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Melanie. My pleasure.
So to get things started, in the beginning of the book, you tell the story of your personal journey and, you know, what led you to doing this profound work, because this is not for everybody, the type of person who, you know, who does this sort of thinking. And so what was your personal story? I know you had an epiphany in Mexico, I believe. What led you to doing what you're doing today?
Yes, thank you very much, Melanie. So indeed, I think this vision for society, I have to recognize, is of course rooted in my own personal experience of awakening, we could say, to the deep inner dimension of our lives and recognizing how much potential there is in each of us and how little society is actually helping us in manifesting this potential, while actually it's what also we need collectively to deal with many of our challenges. So for me, that awakening was in when I was doing a student exchange in Mexico when I was 22 years old. I was about to finish my study, and I, as part of that, I was a student exchange of 6 months in Mexico. And I had different experiences of reconnection to myself, and especially through the reconnection also with Mother Earth, in contact with native spirituality in Mexico. I met some chamans, and when I was able to, for the first time of my life, to see clearly a spiritual path, something in me recognize that this was what I've always longed for without able to put a name on it until then. So I recognized that was what I was looking for, and I decided to completely reprioritize my life, putting that spiritual path at the center and knowing that that spiritual path would be a path of service, and in particular to Mother Earth. So this led me to, when I came back, I had, you know, like last semester of studies to do in France, and I took some extra courses to change my kind of major into international development, to be actually, you know, in service to others. And later on, I did a PhD in ecological economics, really to be in service of the forest, because I, in that reconnection to myself, I'd experienced also a very deep natural connection to the forest. And to me, that was really what I wanted to do.
I love this so much. And I already have so many questions. So you're using the word, you know, that you had this spiritual awakening. And one of the things you talk about in the book is what the word spirituality actually means and how is it different from religion. And I know for me, for example, I was raised very religious. So I was raised in like the Bible Belt Christian South. And then I feel like I developed into more of a spiritual appreciation of the world. So my question here is, like, what is the difference between religion and spirituality? And also, you share a really fascinating statistic in the book, something about how I think societies with like less religion overall are happier, but then within a society, those who pronounce themselves as religious are happier. So it's like this paradox. So I'm really curious, the difference between spirituality and religion, and how do both of those relate to a person's experience of happiness or fulfillment or contentment?
Thank you, Melanie. So to me, spirituality is a kind of spark that have been at the roots of all religion. And it's rooted in that experience. There are, you know, different names that mystics put to that experience of oneness, of unity, consciousness, or interbeing. So I think it's, you know, that experience of our divine nature, basically, which connect us with everything. And spirituality to me is a science, art, and practice of that inner connection, transformation, and fulfillment. So it's really about how to transform ourselves to be able to manifest our true divine nature, let's say. And religion then are more like historical institutions that have grown out from this experience, from the spiritual experience. And as such, you know, they are facing all the limitations of, you know, social institutions, human institutions. So, you know, search for power, for example, or for control, etc. My focus really is on spirituality itself. And I think at this moment of time, and that has been very much part of my own past, we have access to so many spiritual traditions that I think if you really are searching for God, yes, it's good to be rooted in one tradition to go deep, but I don't see, you know, the reason why one should limit himself in his connection to God to, you know, one book, for example. I think all the knowledge and experience of humanity in search of the divine can be of use for anyone looking for that, you know, divine connection.
Gotcha. And that searching nature, I've always been really interested by this. You spoke about how you were longing for something prior to your epiphany, but you didn't have language for it really. And then you had your realization and embraced this spirituality, you know, new insight that you had. Prior to that, when you were in the searching phase, there's this like trope or type of person you will come across, which maybe that's what you were, where it's like, I'm searching for something, like I feel like I'm missing something and I'm searching for this thing. And I feel like some people have that experience and others don't. Like for me, I'm always searching for new information and knowledge. Like that's why I have this show, is to like, I just love learning and sharing. I haven't had the experience that I hear people talk about where they feel like they're missing something though, and they're like searching to fill that. And so I'm wondering, when it comes to a person's journey with all of this, does it matter if you're coming from just looking, not just, but looking for new information versus coming from, you feel like you're missing something or lacking something? Does that make sense? I've seen this in people, and I've wondered why I don't have that experience of feeling like I'm missing or lacking something.
Well, it seems at least you're missing the miss. So that's already a first step.
No, so that's so true. Oh my goodness. Do you have thoughts there? Like the actual, like what's driving somebody to look for this information?
Yeah, well, I think it's a soul inside each of us who is, you know, more or less active and to the front, but inside each of us, there is this calling, there is this need, but it can be blurred, let's say, by, you know, our mind, or, you know, our desires, or our mind, our habits, you know, all this, the very more human part, let's say. But the spark is in each of us, and it's the soul that is guiding us back to the divine, to its own divine nature. It's a soul, I think, that is helping us really connect with itself. Yeah, I think there is, you know, this is not necessarily purely, I mean, when we are missing something, it's not necessarily comfortable. And that's why we tend to probably, you know, not want to feeling that so much, right? So I think as part of this path, there is a very important step, which is to recognize that actually something is missing, and that which we could call also in general, you know, the suffering. And that's, I think, a very noble truth, as they say in Buddhism, that this is the start of the Buddhist path, is a recognition of suffering. And what I've seen around me when I was young, etc., is that, you know, I saw that, and I say in the book, I saw when I was young that people were pretending, and then that they were all fine, etc. And then I just realized they were just unconscious because they were not able to accept the fact that something was wrong. To me, that's really the important, the first step on the spiritual path.
Okay, so that probably hits on my personal fear that I have here because, and maybe it's just because of the way I'm categorizing what I'm searching and looking for, and I'm using different terminology, but that is what I sometimes wonder. I'm like, because I don't have what I perceive as like this thing, missing thing that I'm trying to find, I'm like, oh, maybe I'm just not even in tune at all to the spiritual journey. And I'm, like you said, I'm like waiting to be awoken. That is really interesting. Another related question, and I've been haunted by this since high school. Like, I literally remember it was our first honors English class, and it's when they were introducing us to, I remember they were like, our teacher was like, do you know what the word metaphysics means? And he's like, do you know what the word epistemology means? And then thus entered the concept of paradigms and knowledge and how do we know what we know? And so I'm really curious because in your book, you profile quite a few different leaders over the past, like spiritual leaders. And you talk about the role of our paradigm and how we are defined by our paradigm, and it limits the future that we can envision because we're in our paradigm. So my question is, which is one that's haunted me for ages, is how do we know, like, how do you know who to follow and whose knowledge to take into your paradigm? And how do you know, like, if you're seeing everything from your paradigm, how do you know it's the paradigm that is the paradigm that you that you want to be promoting if it's from your paradigm? Just how do we know?
You know, first, my search with this book has been, what is a wisdom-based approach to development or human development? To me, that's very important because I think, first, the wisdom-based approach is the only legitimate approach, right? I think that's, to me, the compass, the best compass that we can find. And maybe I've come to realize that as part of my spiritual journey, that if there was something I can trust and that is foundational enough, you know, to guide my life, it should be a spiritual compass or it should be wisdom, right? And I'm personally quite surprised that, you know, we are not realizing that collectively, because to me, that the legitimate approach to ask the question, what is a wise or wisdom, a wise paradigm, let's say, for humanity? And I found the answer in the Earth Charter, which says human development is primarily about being more rather than having more. And then I realized nobody really, this was a very important document. There was a huge consultation process. Religious, ethical tradition, I've been very involved into it. And I realized nobody really defined what it means theoretically and in practice, being more. And that's what the book is about. It's called The Politics of Being. How do we organize society for being more? So, yeah, I would say in general, using other words, I've personally taken refuge in that spiritual understanding of life and in wisdom in general. And I can't see a better foundation to, you know, think about the world and our lives.
I love it too. And I was thinking a similar thought while reading your book, which is not that it's obvious, but it's like this approach of what you're saying makes so much sense. It is kind of like, why are we not thinking about this or embracing this more? Which I think I'm a little bit biased because in my world of like biohacking, which maybe that's a good question to talk about, it's all about self-improvement, physically, mentally, emotionally. It's all about that search of trying to better yourself as a human. So when it comes to this idea of like being more versus having more, how does that role of bettering yourself factor into that? What are the values of, maybe we should start there. What are the values of being more? Like, what does that practically look like?
Hi, friends. You guys know I am obsessed with safe, effective skincare. One of my favorite skincare brands of all time, which is USDA Certified Organic, yes, actually Certified Organic, is Purity Woods. And friends, I'm going to be completely honest here. I already had a few skincare brands that I loved when I first found Purity Woods. So I was like, okay, another skincare brand? It was going to take a lot for me to actually add something new into my routine. Oh my goodness. The second I tried Purity Woods, it became a complete non-negotiable. And when I interviewed the founder, Brian Vasily, on my podcast, that's when I learned why. Brian discovered the astounding clinically studied benefits of organic maple leaf extract for the skin. Maple leaf extract contains antioxidant and hydrating properties that help soothe irritated or inflamed skin while also helping to plump, brighten, and nourish the appearance of your skin. So we're talking skin firming, anti-aging, all the things. It's sometimes even called plant-based Botox because of how effective it is. There are three of their products that I use every single day and night of my life. That would be their age-defying dream cream, which I use, yes, during the day, their age-defying night cream, which I use at night, and their hyperlift serum, which I use both morning and night. Every time I put these products on my skin, I just have this sigh of relief. They feel that good, they smell wonderful, I see the effects of my skin, and I just love them that much. And as you know, I am neurotic about having non-toxic ingredients. These products are incredible. You could eat them, but please don't eat them. And Purity Woods has an incredible offer for you guys. You can get up to 38% off at puritywoods.com/Melanie. Turn back time on the appearance of your skin with Purity Woods Age-Defying Dream Cream. Go to puritywoods.com/Melanie at checkout for up to 38% off. That's puritywoods.com/Melanie. I am obsessed with Purity Woods and I can't wait for you guys to try it as well.
Yes, so being more, I define it very simply as becoming who we really are and the best version of ourselves. So there is this two dimension, you know, let's say our truest being, and this is, you know, very subjective and personal, and there is our highest being, and this is about, you know, the highest human values and qualities. So that's at a personal level. And I think my main point is that society should be organized to help us become who we are and be a better person, simply. And what this means in society is to center the highest human values, whether it's truth, goodness, and beauty, for example, as Plato has been promoting, or whether, I think nowadays these values are emerging at the core of many social change paradigm, and have also becoming fields of research so that science can tell us how to cultivate them at the individual, but also at the collective level. So there we're talking about values such as, I call it in the book, understanding the interconnected nature of the world. So that's systemic complex thinking, for example. Centering life and nature, you know, as a pattern that can, you know, a wise pattern that we can imitate. Happiness, love, compassion, empathy, peace, mindfulness. I think all these values can become the foundations for our institutions, for our policies and laws, for the ways we are organizing ourselves in many sectors. And I give a lot of examples on how to do that, on what this means concretely in many sectors in the book.
All of this sounds really great. Like, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find somebody who would outwardly say that they don't want society to support this. What values are being supported currently in society? Is it instead like GDP and quote progress and consumerism and materialism? What is actually being supported today?
Exactly. So, you know, if we're looking, so it's really about understanding, you know, what is the current paradigm, both cultural paradigm and in terms of development paradigm, the way we see progress. So I think our culture in, let's say, Western societies, but more and more all over the world, is really shaped by the modern mindsets and values such as materialism, individualism, reductionism, anthropocentrism, just to say a few ones. So these are values that are really that have really become central through that process of modernity. And what has been, so that's a cultural level. And how do they translate into a program for societies in terms of progress? It has been really shaped by the centrality of economy and seeing progress in material terms, which we didn't do before a few centuries ago. And so seeing progress in material terms, and especially having this vision of human nature, of what we call in economy homo economicus, where we are assuming that human nature is to be selfish, competitive, and looking only, people would be looking only at their own material gains. And that's a mistaken vision of human nature, very simplistic. But the problem is that most of our institutions rely on that and actually are enacting it. So, you know, even the most I'm quoting, for example, in the book, Elinor Ostrom, who have been the most influential scholars analyzing our institutions, and she received the Nobel Peace. She was the first woman to receive the Nobel Peace of the Nobel Prize of economics. And she really said that you know, what she learned from all of her work, the main lesson she drew is that instead of assuming that we are all selfish and competitive and enacting that, we should rather design institutions that bring out the best in humans. That's her own sentence. We have to understand that at the moment, all societies are actually bringing out really things that are not the best in humans, whether it's greed, it's competition, selfishness. And we should become aware of that and redesign our institutions so that we can bring out the values that I mentioned, the highest human values. Because what's happening right now is really a result of this old paradigm worldview of modernity and its vision of human nature.
Amazing. Yeah, so a question there, and that's something that I've actually noticed in my just like conversations with friends and people, especially like the selfishness part and the safeness of society. So starting with the, which one should I start with? Well, the safe one. So I have heard, that we actually you say this in the book, I think, that we actually live in the safest time right now, or most peaceful time, I think. And you talk about something I hadn't heard about before, which was, you know, positive versus negative peace. Well, so first of all, so is that true that we actually live in like the safest time right now and the most peaceful time?
Yes, physically, we could say in terms, if you look at homicide rates, we are in a very low historical level. So there is definitely less people killed in terms of statistics than in any other time of history.
And so it's, I'm assuming it's just the, like the news and the cultural, you know, perspective we have that has created this feeling of that, you know, it's everything's unsafe and everything's really horrible.
Yeah, on the other side, I think there is, in terms of psychological safety, this is also different, and maybe even economic or livelihood safety. And I think that's, you know, a very important topic. So the way the economic system, for example, has evolved has made us, you know, completely dependent on the market. You know, we all need to find a job to sustain ourselves. In the past, everybody was, you know, self-sufficient through their own farm, and there was not, you know, that insecurity, let's say. I mean, sometimes maybe there was some bad harvest, bad year, but, you know, we were not so much dependent on external conditions economically. I'm saying that because people have analyzed in the 1930s the rise of fascism as a result of, you know, the crisis of 1929 and the fact that people had been made dependent on markets to sustain themselves. So just an historical background that we can also, you know, use to analyze our present times. So I think this economic aspect is important. And I think more generally, in the past, well, when everyone was self-sufficient, having their own farms, etc., let's say, we also had our community. And so there was not right now, people are also feeling much more isolated and much more unsafe, I would say, socially, because we, you know, we all need relationships, community, human connections, and this has become much more unsafe at another level. And there are other, you know, psychological unsafety that, you know, can be linked to other conditions of the modern times, whether it is, you know, the social media, the fact that we are, you know, so connected. Yeah, these, I think, are creating other psychological unsafety, right?
We talk a lot on this show about, you know, the negative effects of social media and what it's doing to us psychologically and, you know, affecting our mental health and wellness. It's really ironic that we're more connected than ever, like connected to so many people, and yet we're, you know, seemingly lonelier than ever. And it's interesting that in a way, because like you're saying, we no longer are a primarily like farming-based society. Like we're not, you know, creating and taking care of our own needs ourselves. We actually are relying on everybody else, like as society. And yet, ironically enough, that makes us feel, you know, less safe and less taken care of, even though we're like relying on each other in a way with society. So it's just really ironic. It's a paradox. The selfish piece. So this is haunting me so bad. The idea of altruism. Do you think it really is possible to be altruistic? I have argued with friends about this for as long as I can remember, which is basically the idea that I don't know. I really can't understand how you would do a completely selfless act, because I feel like everything you do, this is my paradigm, everything you do is you want to do. Like you can't do something you don't actually want to do, I don't think. So the concept of altruism, can we actually do selfless acts?
Yes, definitely. I think, you know, some people are putting their own lives at risk in a moment to save someone and they don't think, you know, too much about it. So, and you're true to mention that in the modern paradigm, the Homo economicus paradigm, we have been educated, taught to think of ourselves as entirely rational and as entirely selfish somehow. But to me, it's just obvious, you know, there are people who are, you know, sometimes losing their lives or putting their lives at risk just to save someone else. And you can't, I don't think it's very honest to interpret that as another mechanism of, you know, selfishness. So then maybe beyond your question, there is also the question about, can we build some communities or societies that can allow this altruism to flourish? And I would say, yeah, definitely yes. And there are some rules that are allowing this altruism to be valued, and also, which is also about sanctioning, you know, the one that are not acting in the interest of the community. If you're being more down to earth, the community also needs to be able to sanction gradually those that infringe the rules and affect negatively the community. So this has been designed by researchers and very well studied. And to say, I wanted to add that, and I mentioned some example in the book about how we tend to, in all societies, we tend to not recognize how much we are or potential for goodness. And there have been some studies who actually demonstrate it. You know, like they are asking people, when you ask people about their own values, and then when you ask people about what do you think are the values of society, of others, it doesn't match. You know, people always tend to think that the problems are the fact that the other ones are not ready to play that game of solidarity and helping each other. But we are maintained artificially in that belief, which prevent us from coming together and support each other. And I think there are some powerful interests that are supporting this vision and preventing us from realizing that.
Okay, two big questions there. Clarification. So in the studies on the values, people think that the values of other people are like not good values, or they think they are good values?
So in this study, they have asked people to... they have grouped values in two categories. One are more like compassionate values, and the other are, you know, not so compassionate, let's say. And they are asking, and people tend to, you know, it might be, I can't remember exactly, but it might be like 70% of people declare their own values as compassionate values. But when they are asked, what are the values of others in society? Compassionate values will come only at 50%, for example. So there is a mismatch between what everybody thinks. So everybody, you know, a lot of people are ready to play that game of solidarity, let's say. But they think it cannot happen because others are not ready, and they will lose if they are the only ones playing that game.
So that's so interesting, because earlier in the episode when I was saying, well, clearly everybody would want this to be the way it is, like these values leading society, I was assuming everybody holds these values. And when I was saying that, I was thinking, you know what, maybe I'm making a false assumption here about others' values. It's kind of like the opposite of what that study found. Like, I think I overassume everybody has these values, although maybe they do. This is really, really interesting. Okay, question about going back to the altruism. So you gave the example of somebody saving their life for somebody else, and that's, you know, an example of a selfless act. And my question here, so say you have a situation where somebody could save somebody else, like sacrifice their life in that moment for the other person. I think one person might do that and another person might not. And I would still argue either way that the decision the person makes, like whether or not to sacrifice themselves for somebody else, it's still what they want to do. So that's why I feel like it's hard to escape, or it's hard to say that there's actually a selfless act, because in the end, they did what they want to do. It's just that one person, it makes them, for whatever reason, they wanted to like sacrifice themselves for this other person, and then another person maybe didn't want to. And so then it makes me think, well, then it really just comes down to what do people actually want deep down? And we just have to hope that people want things that look like altruism. Maybe altruism exists, but I've been skeptical since I was little. I don't know if there was a question there, but do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's obviously, you know, even if they don't think too much about it, you know, if you considering that they are taking a decision, you can say that they want to do. But the fact that they want to do that doesn't mean it's selfish. You know, they want to do that for the good of someone else. And you know, when you put your life at risk, I don't think you can deny that. So, yeah, I don't see why the fact that people decide to do something or want to do something would make it, prevent it to be an altruistic act. I think these are just two different things.
That's actually a really good reframe. I hadn't thought about that before. I thought about this for so long. So, okay. Well, speaking of, so related to that, because I am viewing and framing things by what does the person actually want? And that's the way I'm, you know, using it as a measure of things. When it comes, this is a question I have for you because it's something I feel and experience. When it comes to happiness and contentment with cultivating the state of being that you're talking about, you know, becoming your true self, supporting those sorts of values, does it matter the types of things that you do in life that make you feel like your true self and content, what they actually are? And what I mean by that is, like, I kind of self-identify as a workaholic. So, like, I love work. It makes me feel alive and passionate. But then I wonder, is that going into the world of workaholism? And is that, like, a negative thing? So do we need to judge what makes us feel like our true selves?
Hi, friends. Would you like to have the most epic eating experience? I'm talking eradicate bloating and better absorb your nutrients. If so, you need digestive enzymes. These are one of my most favorite supplements out of everything I take, and I truly cannot imagine my life without them. Digestive enzymes are key to break down your food into usable nutrition and to stop things like bloating, digestive distress, constipation, all the things. That's why I created Avalon X Digest. And you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. You can also get a subscription and save 15%, which you can pause or cancel at any time. Friends, I worked so hard to create the perfect blend of enzymes for Avalon X Digest. It's a full-spectrum, plant-based enzyme blend with proteases to help you break down protein, amylase for carbs, lipase for fats, cellulase for fiber, and so much more. In fact, there are 13 different types of enzymes in this blend. I cannot tell you how many people have told me that when they take Avalon X Digest, they experience no digestive distress with meals. These are truly game changers. And for any of you guys looking to up your protein intake, Avalon X Digest will help you actually break down and assimilate your protein so you get more protein from your meals. I wanted to create the highest potency enzymes so that you get all of these benefits when you eat with no problematic fillers or ingredients. Avalon X Digest is also tested multiple times for purity and potency, comes in glass bottles, and is truly the best enzymes on the market. And again, you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us.
No, I mean, from an individual perspective, definitely no. Maybe my reflection is more about how can we align our personal development with what is good for society. And we tend to think of these two things as almost antagonistic in the paradigm of having, where, you know, for me to have more, basically other people needs to have less somehow, right? That's in the material paradigm we're in. But in the being paradigm, actually, I can be more if you are more. And there are some very good research that shows that human flourishing or inner development is actually good for people and society. So the two can really reconcile themselves. And I would say the pathway to that is through thinking about human flourishing as an inner development, as a deeper connection to self first. So that has been in all wisdom traditions, like you can become happier just by working on yourself and your attitude towards life, your perceptions, the way you choose to look at what's happening to you and react to it. And connections also with others. All the happiness studies really emphasize the importance of our social relationships with friends, partners, family. That's our primary source of happiness. And connection with nature. We have also more and more scientific evidence of the benefits of being in nature and being connected to nature for health, physical health, mental health, even our, you know, mental functioning and performance. And I think these three connections are, you know, the pathway to the ultimate spiritual, mystical experience of our true nature, which I think is of oneness, of unity, of interbeing, whatever words you want to choose. So all these connections, at the end, they are just one. And that's why someone who is in this path of spiritual realization can cultivate its own well-being and at the same time serve the well-being of others and take care of Mother Earth.
Okay, so big question there. For society to function, like for us to live as humans, we have to have resources, shelter, food, you know, all of these things. And presumably people have different passions and things that make them feel alive. And then that would manifest as different roles in society. I'm just guessing here. You know, a person, as far as what they actually do in life, like their job or their vocation in this ideal society, I'm assuming would align with their true being. So would it just work out that if everybody is living their best life, being their fulfilled self, that it would result in a society where all the quote jobs are covered that we need in society?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it, what you just say also relates to what I presented at the beginning in terms of viewing being with these two poles of our true self or true being on one side. So, you know, we all have our own personal callings and directions in this life. And at the end, or, you know, the best version of ourselves, which is more, you know, a little bit more objective, we could say, of, you know, cultivating human values that are good for society too. So getting back to your question about, yeah, there might be jobs, you know, I think a more evolved society would recognize that there are some jobs that are not very fulfilling and that, you know, maybe no one would choose to naturally, and they will try to minimize them and maybe to distribute them in a fairer manner if we can't completely get rid of them.
Yeah, I'm so fascinated by it. Like, would this society, like, actually, like what would it actually, you know, look like practically? Are there societies today that are doing this, like in their own microcosm?
Yeah, and I realize as I'm speaking that it sounds, you know, so countercultural that, you know, a society can intentionally try to, you know, think in this term and try to, you know, reduce some jobs, etc. Because I think we're just being so used to not being able to give any direction to economic and technological progress. And I think a lot of this is about, you know, getting back the power over our lives and over how we organize society, and technology and economy being a means for us to realize that instead of what they have become now, which is their end in themselves, because we have lost completely our compass as societies. So getting back to your question, what was...
Is there a society today that might be its own? Yeah.
Yeah. This is a common question. Which society are closer to this paradigm of being? And sometimes the question comes, are there rich society? Is it only for rich society? And I think we can find them at two different levels. On one side, I would say the Nordic societies in Europe, Sweden, Norway, Finland, maybe Denmark, Iceland, these are countries that are being considered as the most evolved culturally. And they are a culture of care, culture of partnership, and they identify with these values and image of themselves. And a number of very concrete policies that I recommend, whether in terms of education, of early childhood and family, of work, gender, governance, justice, many of these policies, you can find them in these European Nordic countries. And they are the ones that are, you know, not only the most evolved culturally as per some, you know, the dominant views, such as the World Value Survey, for example, they are also the ones that are performing better according to all social indicators. So it really tells that there is something about politics of being, because where it is more implemented, these are the societies that are actually performing better. And on the other side, I think, you know, Nordic European countries are also, you know, have some limitations and, you know, may not be the more, you know, spiritually inclined, for example, which could be also a limitation in that agenda. The other part of it would be more indigenous societies. I'm working myself, for example, with Bhutan, you know, this small Himalayan country, which have championed gross national happiness as an alternative development paradigm to economic growth. These are very indigenous societies, in that case, with, you know, Buddhist values that are very much alive. And we can see that in other indigenous communities in different parts of the world.
So you live in the south of France. The actual, like, town you live in, why did you choose where you live?
Yeah, so I live next door to a famous mindfulness practice center or a Buddhist monastery called Plum Village of Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh, who has been one of the most influential Buddhist teacher in the recent times, and who have been sometimes recognized as the father of the mindfulness movement. And I've been living here for the last 11 years, really as a result of giving priority to my spiritual path and in agreement with my wife, who is on the same path.
It's incredible. I remember the first time I heard about Thich Nhat Hanh, and it was actually Charles Eisenstein's book, The Yoga of Eating, because I was recording the audiobook for it. And I was like, I don't know how to say this guy's name. That's amazing. I'm curious, because you were mentioning like technological developments and what would this society look like. I'm very curious. What do you think about the rise of AI? How do you think it will support how do you think it will factor into this, the ideal future that you see? And do you use it? Like, do you use ChatGPT and stuff?
Not so much. I do for very specific use, but not so much in general. I mean, the way I see AI, if you think about the evolution of humanity and from a biological perspective, let's say, where, you know, there is the body, there is a development with animals of the more vital part, we could say, with, you know, emotions and desires, etc. And then there is a development of the mental sphere, the mind, and we're getting more intellectual. And in the 20th century, humanity has even started to fight for ideologies. No, so to me, that's a kind of cultivation of the mental age. And I think that AI also is really about, you know, about what our mind can do. And I think we are at this stage of humanity to become more reflective about our mind and recognizing that at the end, our mind are also somehow, you know, a big biological machine. And I think what's really, and that can lead us, that can open the door to search for, you know, who we really are behind all that. Are we only our minds and what we are thinking, or is there something behind? Which I think there is, and we could call that the soul or the spirit. So I think what's interesting with AI is that it's really externalizing all what our, most of what our mind can do in terms of thinking and giving it to a machine. And then we should become more reflective because, you know, now our mind and our thinking are outside of us and we can look at it. And that's where, you know, we can start to reflect where this is coming from, you know, how this knowledge is produced and start to be more reflective about our thinking and our mind. And at the same time, wondering, you know, if all what we think was, you know, what was defining our humanity was our capacity of thinking somehow. But that is no longer the case with AI. You know, that can be done now by computers. So what is now defining our humanity? I think this question will lead us to increasingly search for our true self as souls rather than minds and redefine what can be our added value as human beings, which will no longer be about knowledge, but maybe more about, you know, that capacity to be maybe self-reflective. Even AI maybe is starting to has a little bit of that because you can do that mentally. But maybe it's more about, you know, the heart, our capacity to love, our capacity to connect with each other, to collaborate. So I think, yeah, there is a lot of obvious, you know, risk with AI, and they are very deep because of the societies we are in. But, you know, every challenge has also its evolutionary potential. And I think, you know, these are some of our new creations that are, you know, leading back to the question of our times, I believe, which is, you know, getting to understand who we really are and what we are here for.
If you could see all of the conversations I have with AI, because I am seeking, I'm like asking it these types of questions, like you're saying, I'm so curious about, because it presents as something that seems self-aware, but I'm assuming it's not, unless it is, and it's going to take over. But in any case, it is a good sign, I think, because presumably, you know, these machines are trained on the entirety of the information out there, like on the internet. And I have found in my interactions that it seems to be pro, you know, the sort of values that we're talking about on this show. As far as like, if I'm talking to it about, you know, personal things I'm doing or needing like advice, or I don't know if I should use the word wisdom, but I guess it's a good thing that at least the way it talks is in support of, from my experience, values that I respect. Although it could just be all it could be all an act. At the end of the book, you propose a wisdom council. So what is that you're proposing there?
Yeah, so this is in the chapter on governance, right? And I've been looking into some, there's some good reference for this work on governance. I like to tell the story of, you know, a book that I've been very important for my reflection, which is about, it's called Intelligent Governance in the 21st Century. And what they've done, they have searched for an ideal systems of governance, and they have asked Asian researchers, some of the best in political science, and also Western researchers, some of the best also too. And both have worked separately, and they have come with a very similar system, actually. I won't describe it too much now, but it's also a system that have very striking parallels with the way one religion is being organized, the Baha'i faith. For people who don't know, the Baha'i is a religion of more than 5 million people. It has based on a prophet coming from Iran in the 19th century, and with very interesting teachings about, you know, saying that all the prophets, all the religions were coming from the same divine source, and they just vary because their message needs to be adapted to the times and space where they are, where they appear to support human evolution, basically. And they say that they realize that every prophet, new prophet, was hindered by the way religions were organized, because religions becomes, you know, an institutional power, and they don't want their power to be threatened. So he wanted to think about the administration of its own tradition in a way that would prevent that, which is to say without clergy. And he designed a system of governance, and he said that this could become a template for the world. And, you know, so I found it striking that in the beginning of the 21st century, when political scientists are thinking of an ideal governance systems, they are getting back to very similar system than the Baha'i Faith. So just as an introduction about my way of thinking about governance. And this, in that, you know, institutional system that I proposed, there is this wisdom council. And this wisdom council is about, its mission is to steer the direction of societies in, you know, if we put, let's say, that we need to organize for being more and put that in the constitution, let's say, of a given country, then it's the role of the Wisdom Council to steer the evolution of societies through the right research and the right debates and give them some power, yeah, to ask government to report on that and even to ask the parliament to develop and the governments to develop some policies to address the issues this body would find. So yeah, that's in a nutshell the vision of this Wisdom Council.
Well, this has been absolutely incredible. Was there any particular topics? Because there's so much in the book. And so, friends, I cannot recommend enough getting Politics of Being. It goes so, so deep into all of these different topics. We can't even briefly touch on all of it. Was there any particular topics you wanted to draw attention to for our listeners?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe just to clarify maybe where we are at the moment and what this polycrisis or meta-crisis or crisis of civilization that we are facing. Because I think it's a very, we have to understand its true nature also in these difficult times to really make sense of what we are experiencing. So I think it's just, as I said, we have been organizing for the more and more for the last two centuries according to the modern paradigm. And this has, you know, provided a lot of benefits, material progress, technological progress, democracy, human rights, etc. But now it has come to the limit. This model, this paradigm has come to its limit of what it can do for us, because it has also created a lot of problems that it cannot address. To address this problem, especially inequality, especially the environmental crisis, or the mental health crisis, the human alienation crisis, we need to move to another paradigm. So what we are living now is an evolutionary crisis. So it's the more we stick to the same paradigm, the worst it will go. And that's, we are seeing that. But we have to remind also that this evolution, this collective evolution we are called to do to solve our challenges can be a wonderful breakthrough of humanity. And I actually believe that humanity is about to enter adulthood. And obviously teenagehood is a very difficult times, but we have to understand that we are going through this so that we can establish much better foundations for the world to come. And I think these people have been waiting for very long for this age. And this spiritual evolution also has been announced by many prophets, including Jesus Christ, which, you know, was main message was about the you know, establishing the kingdom of God. And that's, you know, in a secular perspective also, because I think we need to bring these, we need to be able to think about these things in also in rational and secular terms. This is what is about the politics of being, is about how do we, you know, because if we start to organize our societies for being more, this is how we will nourish the kind of human being, the kind of culture that can bring us to this better world. So just a message of hope and understanding that many times, you know, in that evolutionary process, the worst and the best are, you know, competing with each other. And sometimes we need the worst so that people really have the courage to go for the best too.
Another resource for you guys. If you struggle with food sensitivities like I do, you have got to get my app, FoodSense Guide. It's a comprehensive catalog of over 300 foods for 11 potentially problematic compounds. These include things you may be reacting to, like gluten, lectins, FODMAPs, histamine, oxalates, sulfites, thiols, whether or not something is a nightshade, and so much more. It even includes autoimmune paleo AIP status. You can learn about the compounds, create your own list to share and print, and finally take charge of your food sensitivities. It is a top Apple app, often in the top 10 for the Apple food and drinks charts. And friends, get it now because I'm going to be updating it to a subscription basis soon. So you definitely want to get grandfathered in for life at one super low price. With the subscriptions, by the way, I'm going to be implementing some pretty cool features. So I need to do subscriptions to help support that. So like I said, get it now before we change to subscriptions. You can get it at melanieavalon.com/foodsenseguide.
When you're saying this idea of like humanity is like teenagers and it's a hard time and then entering adulthood and this maturation level, you're saying for the entire history of humanity or like humans within a certain period of time? Because if we had these other societies in the past, like these indigenous cultures that potentially were already hitting that mature level of adulthood. So is it like the entire history of humanity? You're saying we're moving finally towards this adulthood?
Yeah, I would say at least for, you know, what we know of history of, let's say, which is often, a couple of thousands of years, I would say this is really the first time that we can establish this global enlightened, we could call it, society, because that's where lie the answers to the problems we are facing. So evolution is pushing us in that direction right now. Yeah, some cultures have the idea that there have been many cycles in human history of thousands of years, and there have been ups and downs, etc. I think we don't know very precisely about that, but for the history we know, I think this is a very unique time indeed.
Oh wow! Okay, that is amazing. Do you see something that indicates that?
Yeah, I mean, just to explain a little bit more, I mentioned about my experience in Mexico in the early 2000s, and one of the first things I learned when I started to live in Mexico at that time was a Mayan prophecy about a change of consciousness in 2012, right? Which was supposed to be the end of a 25,000-year cycle and the beginning of a new cycle. And there are many others. You know, I was just mentioning the Baha'i Faith, which is one of the latest prophets, has also announced that actually humanity was about to enter adulthood. That was the kind of language he was using. And yeah, I see a lot of people in, especially those that are more spiritually inclined, really living that understanding that we are in a very special times of history, and that is a time of spiritual evolution. And in my own work, I've not mentioned, but I'm working with United Nations. I'm working with Conscious Food Systems Alliance, where we are making the case that we need this inner development for the transformation of food and agriculture. And we are being successful and considered as very relevant. So I think this is quite new. Maybe a couple of years ago, this would have not been possible. But right now, working with, you know, decision makers, working with people that are deep thinkers around sustainability and social change and what is needed, I think there is a consciousness growing very quickly, an awareness growing very quickly, that the answers to our problem imply looking inside and this kind of inner transformation at the collective level. And I think this is growing very quickly. And, you know, I really hope and trust that it would become mainstream, I would say, in the coming years and decades, because that's the way to go.
Thank you so much for all of this work that you're doing. How can listeners practically make choices daily that move towards this? So does just, I don't like this word, just working on yourself as a person and doing what makes you feel fulfilled and happy and working in service of others, is that enough to move towards this? How should people practically, does it come down to even things like how you shop and what you buy and who you vote for? Like how do people best help move humanity collectively towards this?
Yeah, so I think an important aspect is the realization that all these good behaviors doesn't, you know, come out of nothing. And we all have a responsibility to cultivate ourselves, to become more compassionate, to become more conscious, to become wiser. So I think that's, to me, the first step. And then how to bring that in the world through, as we say, through, you know, being engaged in the world and trying to support others, trying to live in harmony with nature. And also, what is the kind of narrative, of paradigm, of culture that we are cultivating, that we are nourishing, the way, you know, the way we speak, the way we relate with people? I think our ways of being, they can be quite subtle, but we need to really become aware of what is the kind of consciousness that each of us is promoting around us. And that's, I think, our responsibility in that process of collective evolution.
I love this so much. I mean, it's interesting because I know this is all about, you know, quote, politics, but, you know, a new paradigm for that. And I personally, like when it comes to the colloquial word of politics, like I don't watch the news. I don't really get politically super invested. And again, that this is like the definition of it as it's understood today. And yet everything I do, like with this show, is because I feel like my purpose is to find information and share it with people so that they can, you know, better their own lives. And so I love this idea of agency and, like, you know, working on ourselves and having the whole, because you have all these beautiful paradoxes in the book of, like, you know, the parts being in the whole and the whole in the parts and all the things. So I guess it's just a call to action to people to keep, you know, keep on keeping on and finding the things that make them feel alive and supporting each other. And I cannot thank you enough for your work. It's so, so incredible. Which, to that point, how can people best follow your work, support your work? Are you writing any new books? What is on the horizon for you?
Yes, so they can buy the book on all platforms. They can go to the website, politicsofbeing.com. We're starting also a book club for those that are wants to discuss with others around the book. There's a YouTube channel, and I'm on social media too, especially LinkedIn. So yeah, they are all welcome to connect. And yeah, I think I'm still building, you know, that community. I've been very busy in the last few years since the book was published, but, you know, especially with this book club, now building that community to see what we can do together. My vision is really about, you know, developing that network that with people from different fields that can, you know, help each other to implement that broader vision of a politics of being. But also more simply, I think what I'm on the website, there is a page with a book club. And I think that's something people can bring to their community, bringing people, and I'm testing that, and I will develop some guidance. But I think that's something that people can organize, you know, read the book with their friends and neighbors and just discuss it. we will have some materials to help people do that.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. I will put links to all of this in the show notes so listeners can check all of that out. And I'm thinking about how like when I, you know, was in school and was reading all of these different, you know, books and historical works and philosophers and all the things. And I think your book should be required education for children so that we can, you know, instill these values and ideas in them early on. So thank you so much for all that you've done, Thomas. I really appreciate you doing this, especially I know with the time change, it's evening there for you. And just thank you for all that you do. And I look forward to connecting with you more in the future. Oh, I almost forgot. Oh my goodness. Wait, one last question. So the very last question that I ask every single guest on this show, and it's just because I am so passionate about the role of mindset. So what is something that you're grateful for?
There's so many things what I'm grateful for, you know, my wife, my family, my house, my community, my spiritual path. So maybe grateful for life to bring to me each time what I need to evolve, right? I think that's maybe what's the deeper look at it, probably.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Thomas. This was absolutely amazing, and I look forward to connecting with you more in the future.
Thank you so much, Melanie, for your work, and likewise, let's stay connected.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information and resources, you can check out my book, What, When, Wine, as well as my supplement line, Avalon X. Please visit melanieavalon.com to learn more about today's guest, and always feel free to contact me at contact@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.